I can scarcely remember how I got out of the building. I gathered my books and papers together in any order, rammed them into my briefcase, and made for the door. I did not pause to listen to the sounds that were audible from the staircase now, but dashed down to the ground floor and through the front door, all but falling down the steps onto the pavement. I did not halt for breath or thought until I was back in my rooms in the Canongate. I turned on all the lights and sat for half an hour shaking, slowly collecting myself. I put a record on my stereo and played it softly. Bach violin concertos, the most soothing music I could find. Gradually, the music and the familiar surroundings began to restore me to a sense of normality. It was about 3 in the morning when I finally went to bed, tired out both physically and mentally. I fell asleep at once. I remember nothing of my dreams, nor do I know precisely what it was that woke me. All I recall is that I started out of sleep with an indefinable yet powerful sense of dread. A feeling that the darkened room around me was alive with something even darker. It must have been about 4:30, with dawn still some time away. Gradually, the first feelings of panic started to subside, but even as they did so, I became conscious of sounds above the ceiling of my room. They were not the flapping and scraping noises I had heard in the rooms above the library, but seemed more like footsteps. At first, I thought there must be someone in the room above me, pacing his floor, unable to sleep. Then I remembered that there was no room above mine. Dawn came at last, pale and weak, the light gradually strengthening as it filtered through my curtains. As the darkness was gradually dispelled, the sounds seemed to grow weaker until they finally faded completely. I fell into a deep and dreamless sleep. I slept through all of the next day, a Saturday, and neither dreams nor sounds disturbed me. I was woken shortly after 9 on Sunday by the sound of knocking at my door. A voice came from behind the door. "Andrew, are you there? Are you all right?" It was Ian Gillespie. With an enormous effort, as if freeing myself from cords tying me to the bed, I pulled myself up. I struggled to stand and managed to get to the door. As it opened, I saw Ian's concerned face. Then, unable to stand any longer, I collapsed onto the floor. I came round later to find Ian hovering anxiously over me. 20 minutes later, I saw Dr. McLean come through the door. He examined me briskly but carefully, and at last pronounced himself satisfied. "Well, Andrew, I have to say I'm very disappointed in you. I'd taken you for a man with greater sense. Do your parents know what sort of state you've got yourself into?" "What's wrong with me?" "You're overworked. Your nervous system's been taxed to its limit, and you haven't got over the death of your young woman." His heavy eyebrows knotted, and he looked down at me severely. "You'll wreck your health permanently if you don't do something about it. I'm going to prescribe a herbal tonic and plenty of rest." As he reached the door, he turned and looked at me. "Would you mind telling me how you got those marks on your face and hands?" "Marks?" I looked at my hands in puzzlement. To my astonishment, I found several angry red wheals, circular in shape, each about the size of a 1p coin. I shook my head. He looked strangely at me. "Well, they're very mysterious," he said. "When I first saw them, I thought they might be a rash of some sort. Then I took a closer look and saw they were all contusions, as if the skin had been pressed or sucked very hard, leaving some bruising. But surely you have some idea of how you came by them?" "No," I said, in all honesty. "Well," said Dr. McLean, "I'll call in tomorrow." He left, and I leaned back against the pillows. I was tired, in spite of having slept for so long, but I felt afraid to shut my eyes. All I could think of was a group of white-fleshed creatures sucking the bodies of the dead in an old woodcut. I spent Christmas at home in Stornoway and flew back to Edinburgh on the Tuesday after New Year, ready to return to work in a more positive spirit. From my briefcase, I took out the books and papers I had rammed inside in my panic over a month earlier. The papers were crumpled and torn, and I set to work, flattening and straightening them. Lifting them out, I noticed a book underneath. It seemed disturbingly familiar. I reached into the case and lifted it out. It was bound in brown leather, very dusty, obviously old. It was the very same volume that had woken that flapping, creeping thing in the darkness and left an image in my brain that nothing could wipe out. The street was as silent as ever, the old house as grey. Nothing had changed. I climbed the steps to the front door and rang the bell. Jurczyk, the old librarian, took his time in coming, but at last I heard the sound of his feet in the passage, shuffling towards the door. When he saw me, his wrinkled face broke into a smile. "Mr. MacLeod, it's very good to see you again. Come in, you must not stand in the cold." I closed the door gently behind me. "I'm sorry," I said, "but when I left, I must have put this book into my bag by mistake. I only found it there this morning when I was unpacking my papers. I realize you may have been worried about its loss. It seems extremely valuable." He took it from me. "There is no library mark," he said. "If it came from here, it would have a label on the spine." "I found it in the second stack," I said, "behind some other books stuck at the back of a shelf." He frowned and opened the book. As his eye fell on the title page, his expression changed. His cheeks, already pale, became ashen white. His eyes brightened with a mixture of fear and anger. Then he slammed the book shut. He did not look at me, but stood staring at the floor, as though struggling to regain control of himself. When at last he did look up, there was a fierce light in his eyes. "You must tell me the truth," he said. "Where did you find this book? It was not found here. Where did it come from?" Frightened and distressed by the abrupt change in the old man's manner, I stammered that I had indeed told him the truth, that the book had been lying under a layer of dust exactly where I had said. "That is impossible," he said. "There has never been a copy of this book here, and even if it had been, it would never be left in public. Such a thing could not be allowed." "I think you are a liar, Mr. MacLeod. Perhaps worse than that. I would like you to leave, and take that with you." He pointed at the book. Pointed at it, but refused to touch it. I picked it up, obeying him out of shock and embarrassment, and dropped it into my briefcase. Back in my rooms, I filled a large glass with whiskey and drank until my nerves felt calm again. The thought of knowingly spending another night alone with the Matrix Eternitatis in my rooms was far from attractive. I was certain by now that the book was, in some sense that I could ill-define, capable of evil. At last, I made my mind up. I got together wood and coals, laid them in my bedroom grate, and lit them. In a little while, the coals caught, and I soon had a good fire going. I collected the book and hastened to throw it on the flames. It seemed almost to resist me. My hand shook as I held it over the grate, as though a force other than my own will was trying to take charge. But I had come this far, and was determined to be done with it. I threw the book onto the coals. It would not catch at first, but then, quite suddenly, it burst into flame, all at once, as though soaked in petrol. Within a matter of minutes, it had been quite consumed. I felt a great weight fall from me. As the days passed, and I put the incident at the fraternity library behind me, my thoughts grew less perturbed. But shortly afterwards, events took another unexpected turn. It was the middle of January, and I was in a pub in Bank Street. Ramsay MacLean had asked me to join him for a drink. The invitation had been phrased quite casually, but I knew it was really to give him an opportunity to check up on my state of health. McLean brought two fine malt whiskies to the table, and we sat and talked like old times. When an hour or so had passed, the doctor set his empty glass on the table. "I have to go," he said. "Evening surgery starts in half an hour. Andrew, you're greatly improved, and by the looks of you, you'll be on top form by the spring." I said I would stay on to wait for Ian, who had promised to join me. McLean shook hands and left, and I went to the bar for a soft drink. I'd barely returned to my table when a man sat down next to me. "Andrew McLeod," he said. "Where on earth have you been hiding?" I turned awkwardly, almost spilling my drink. For a moment I did not recognize him, but his face was not one I associated with the place or the time of day. His name was Duncan Milne, an advocate. He and I had met a few times at the meetings of the Fraternity of the Old Path, of which he was a long-standing member. I had been particularly intrigued by him, for he did not fit the stereotype of the cult adherent in terms of social class, intellect, education, or anything else, as far as I could see. I shook hands and told him I had been ill. "I'm sorry to hear that," he said. He was a man of about 50, in excellent physical shape, conservatively but expensively dressed and well-groomed. "You are becoming a familiar face at our meetings," he said. "I trust it won't be long before we see you back at the Ainslie place." I reddened, not knowing if Jurczyk had spoken to him about me or not. "Look," I started, "I may as well tell you, if you haven't heard already, that I had a spot of unpleasantness with your Mr. Jurczyk. I think he suspected me of trying to steal a book from the library."
"Did you?"
"Oh, no, of course not. Then I don't see why you should make a thing of it." "It was just, he was very angry. I thought he might have spoken to other members."
"Jurczyk?
No, he couldn't have." He paused. There was a trace of whiskey on his lower lip.
"I take it you know about Jurczyk. What happened to him?"
There was something in his voice that made my heart shiver. "He was found dead a couple of weeks ago." I put down my drink. I was suddenly feeling sick. "They found him in the library. He'd been there overnight. A heart attack, so they say."
"When was this exactly?" I asked.
"When? I'm not sure. Early this month, a week or so after New Year."
"Could it have been the 8th?
"Well, it could have been.
Yes, I think it was.
What's wrong?"
That was the day I had the argument with him. You don't think..."
He smiled reassuringly. "Oh, I'm sure not. He was an old man, a sick man. It was just a matter of time. Oh, you shouldn't worry about that."
I looked up and caught sight of Ian on the other side of the lounge coming towards us. As was usual, when he was lecturing, he did not wear his dog collar. For some reason, it relieved me that he did not. As he came up and greeted me, Milne got down from his stool and picked up his coat.
"I've got to be going," he said. "I've got a big case to mug up on for tomorrow morning. Andrew, you must come to a meeting soon. I'll pick you up some evening. We'll go together."
And then he was gone.